Samuel chapter 18, taking a look tonight at Absalom's end. This has not been a very long episode in David's life, at least the actual rebellion part of it. But David's troubles with Absalom have been going on for a long time, stemming all the way back to his murder of his brother, Amnon. And so the family troubles that David has been experiencing have been going on for a very long time. As we've said in our discussions about timeline, we are now looking at somewhere around David's 33rd, 34th, 35th year. Somewhere around there, early to mid-30s is how long he has been on the throne. Not age, but years on the throne. So that means that David is somewhere in his early 60s at this point, and having to flee from his own son who is seeking his life. Absalom is probably in his late 20s, early 30s. He was born after David became king, so he can't be any older than 30, probably 32 or 33. But that gives us some context as to where David's at. So for the last 7 or 8 years, David has been dealing with this family strife. All of it stemming, he knows, from his own indiscretion and from his own failures. David recognizes that he was not the father that he was supposed to be. He was not quite the husband that he was supposed to be. Of course, how do you decide? Should you be a husband to this wife or to that wife? I mean, when you have more than one, how do you decide? But he knows that, and he's experiencing the consequences of his actions here. So he has been chased out of Jerusalem because Absalom has rallied most of Israel to his cause. Absalom has taken over Jerusalem. David fled to the Jordan River. One of David's friends, Hushai the Archite, as we looked at last week, sent David word, said, "Get out of the Jordan River Valley. You're not safe there. Absalom's contemplating coming to get you tonight." And so David fled to Mahanaim, which is, if we pull down our maps here, and down here is the Dead Sea, and to the, let me see, look, that's west, right? Okay. No, that's east for you guys. Okay, so that's east. So the Dead Sea's here. The Jordan River meanders its way up to the Sea of Galilee. Jerusalem is about 20 miles west of the Jordan River and just a little bit south of the top of the Dead Sea. So David fled to the Jordan River. He camped there for a little while, but probably that same evening he got word from Jonathan and Ahimaaz that it wasn't safe there. And so he and his crew of people left there and eventually made their way up the Jordan River Valley. About halfway between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, there's a town called Mahanaim. This is where Ishbosheth had his seat of government for the two or so years that he was king. And so it's not a place that is unbeknownst to the people of Israel. It's also not a small town, but David is there gathering his people. The word "then" there, "then David mustered the men who were with him," that tells us that some time has passed. So we're not looking at like the next day after Absalom enters Jerusalem. There has been a little bit of time. Absalom himself, we read in the end of the last chapter, gathered the armies of Israel. So we're looking at at least several days, probably looking into a couple of weeks worth of time here, that David has been hiding out in Mahanaim while Absalom is gathering his men. But while Absalom's gathering his men, so is David. And he is not completely without supporters. The last few verses of chapter 17 tell us that there were several well-to-do men: Shobi, the son of Nahash, Machir, the son of Amiel, Barzillai, the Gileadite. These people brought supplies for David. They were supporting him in his exile. And so along with them were other people who were still loyal to David and his rule. So David's mustering these men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. So that tells us right off the bat that David's numbers have increased, because how many men left Jerusalem with him? Yeah, a little over 600. There was one guy there who had 600 men, Ittai the Gittite. You got to love these names, right? I mean, these are top 10 of names in 2016 given to newborns. Ittai the Gittite. He, a Philistine from Gath, that's what a Gittite is, had at least 600 men with him. And so we know the men with David and these men were at least 600, probably a few more, but that David is setting commanders of thousands, plural, tells us that David has thousands, plural. And interesting little fact in Hebrew, in English we have a singular and we have a plural, so I can talk about a dog, one dog, Hank, or I can talk about dogs. Ooh, the terror of imagining a world with more than one Hank in it. Wow, the things that could be chewed. All right. So we have a singular and we have a plural in English. Hebrew also has a dual, which means only two. So you can speak in singular, which is just one, or you can speak in dual, which is just two, or you can speak in the plural, which is three or more. So this is a plural word, so it tells us it's not 2,000s, it's 3,000s at least. So David has amassed a bit of an army here, and he's organizing them. So he's setting men over them and commanders of hundreds. He's putting his officers in place. Verse 2, David sent out the army, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. So there are some familiar names for us. Joab and Abishai have been with David since the beginning. These are men who have been loyal to him, but they have also been a bit of a thorn in his side. What things has Joab undertaken that have caused David some strife? What's that? Murder. Who'd he murder? Don't know the name, right? So he murdered, first of all, Abner, which was Ishbosheth's. Saul's son Ishbosheth was king over Israel for a time. And then Abner, Ishbosheth's general, was seeking to unite the two kingdoms under David. And so David was going to make Abner the commander of the army. Joab didn't like that idea, so he murdered Abner. Right? So Joab is a bit of a thorn in David's side. He's a bit of a loose cannon. And David has known that. But right now, he's one of the men that are loyal to David, along with his brother Abishai. And the third man that David has as a commander is Ittai the Gittite, this Philistine from Gath, who has sided himself with David. If you go back to chapter 15, it's in verse 19 that we find out about Gittai. We haven't heard anything about this man up to this point, but as David is leaving Jerusalem and all of his supporters are parading past him and coming with him, he sees Ittai. And David tells him to go ahead and go home. This isn't his fight. This isn't something that he needs to involve himself in. But Ittai answers in verse 27, "As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, whether my lord the king shall be, whether for life or for death or for life, there also will your servant be." So Ittai basically swears this oath of allegiance to David and says, "I'm going with you wherever you go. I'm on your side." And so David knows he's got a man here he can count on. And on top of that, he comes with his own army. I mean, what a thing to have if you're facing rebellion is a friend that comes with his own army of men that are loyal to him. So David enhances that and puts a third of his own army under the command of Ittai the Gittite. "And the king said to the men, 'I myself will also go out with you.'" So here he is giving his instructions to his commanders. This is the briefing before the mission, right? This is the council of war where they'll all get together and the king and his generals and their officers will decide how best to fight the battle. And so David says, "All right, I'm heading out with you. I'm going to go fight this." I think David's probably feeling a little bit of the responsibility for all these events because he recognizes this whole thing is his fault. This isn't just someone rising up to fight against him. This is his own son. And his own son is rising up both because David failed him as a dad and because David failed as an example of a husband and because of the curse that God placed upon David after his sin with Bathsheba. Because God said, "A sword will dwell in your own house as well." This is the fulfillment of what God, the judgment that God placed upon David. So I think he knows that this is his fault and feels the responsibility of that. So how hard would it be for us to send out someone else to clean up our mess? Maybe we drop a bowl full of soup, we like to clean it up ourselves because we feel bad about it, right? So you don't generally drop the bowl of soup yourself and, oh boy, man, that was a bummer. Sorry about that. Jerry, do you mind cleaning that up for me? Thanks so much. No, most of us would, can you give me a towel? I mean, even when we go to restaurants and we spill stuff, we'd like to wipe it up ourselves because we don't want to have to lay that burden on the poor waiter or waitress and the bus people to clean up our messes. So David feels that, I think, and he wants to go out and be part of the solution here. But his men have something against that. In verse 3, they're going to stand up to him a little bit. You shall not go out, for if we flee, they will not care about us. And if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it's better that you send us help from the city. I mean, look at the loyalty expressed here. They understand that this entire affair is about David. And they understand that the kingdom hinges upon David remaining alive for now. What happens if David dies in this battle? Think through the repercussions of that. If David dies in this battle, who becomes king? Absalom becomes king. Now think back to the Davidic promise, the Davidic covenant. Who did God say was going to take the throne after David? It's a little bit of a trick question. He didn't give a name, did he? But he said one of David's sons would take the throne. One of the great promises of the Davidic covenant is that the throne of Israel, there would always be somebody from the Davidic line to sit on the throne. So does Absalom fulfill that? Yes, he does. But God also said, if that son is disobedient, I will punish him with the rod of men. In other words, other nations will come in and I'll use other nations to discipline him. Is Absalom an obedient son or a disobedient son? Disobedient son. So what would that mean for the nation of Israel? It means God would bring in discipline upon the nation because of Absalom. So that's going to be very, very bad if Absalom takes the throne. So they recognize that the hopes, the security, the prosperity, and the future of Israel are bound up in the person of David. That makes him far too valuable to risk him out in open combat. Now, they know David's a mighty man. He's a warrior, so they're not afraid of him being able to hold his own at this point. Imagine that, being 65 years old or so and still able to go out and wield a sword and shoot a bow and keep up with all the 20-year-olds out in battle, right? Boy, I look at the soldiers that come out of our army, and these guys, I mean, they have time to just sit around and pump iron all day long, and so they just come out and muscles all over the place and think, yeesh, yeah, I wouldn't want to have to tangle with that, right? Wouldn't want to have to tangle with that. Well, David's not concerned about that as much, but his men understand. Everything revolves around him. He's the goal. So Absalom has not come to capture a city. He hasn't come for the spoils of war. He hasn't come to defeat an army. What has Absalom come to do? Kill David. So everything else is a detail, right? That's your entire battle plan. Get to David. So if David's out on the battlefield, usually you can identify where the king is at because that's where there's going to be a cluster of servants and generals and things. You focus all your attention on that one point, right? If David's inside the city, well, then you have to focus on taking the city first. So that divides Absalom's forces. It's a very tactical decision to keep David out of the line of battle here when David is the goal of the battle. So one side wins if David dies. The other side wins if David lives. That makes David a pretty high priority. And so they tell him, you're worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it's better that you send us help from the city. There's an old adage that you can't stop somebody from committing an act if they're willing to die doing it, right? Usually we think of that in terms of assassination. If somebody was really intent on killing our president, they could do it if they were willing to die in the attempt. Because then they don't worry about all the security measures that are in place. Most of the time you fail in those attempts because you're trying to do it without getting caught or without getting yourself harmed. But if you're willing to be harmed, it's very hard to stop that. So imagine if David's out on the battlefield and all of Absalom's forces are directed at that one point, it's going to be very difficult for David's army to repel that kind of assault. So they tell him, you need to stay inside the city. You're going to command the battle from there. If it gets hard on this side, you send reinforcements. If it gets hard on that side, you send reinforcements over there. We're dividing things into three groups. So David at this point, verse 4, the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. Interesting change in tone in David, isn't it? Up until this point in his life, he's been the commander, he's been the king, he's been the one calling the shots. When he encountered Saul in the cave, all his men said, kill him right now. And what did David say? I won't raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. Not a chance. There was David asserting what was right, taking command of the situation, and giving orders. When Keilah was besieged by the Philistines, David was the one who said, let's seek what the Lord has, and Lord, should we go up? And it was David taking command of the situation. All throughout his life, that's been David. He's a commander. But we see him at this point yielding to his generals and their thoughts about it. So we see a very different tone. Probably David is really suffering the effects of self-doubt and second-guessing himself in light of what's going on. And so he's willing to be told what to do. He's willing to submit to his leaders at this point. Whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood at the side of the gate while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands. So there he is at the gate. And imagine what David's feeling as all these men are going out. And he knows they're going out to protect him. Doesn't that fill you with a sense of, I don't know. What kind of feeling would that fill you with? Humility? Yeah, there's a good word. Humility, to recognize that all these people think you're important enough to die for, even when you know what you've done and you recognize that you actually deserve to die, but God has pardoned you. Yeah, great, great humility that David's probably experiencing here as his armies pass by. Verse 5, he's got one last thing to say. The king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. Why do you think David shouts out this order now while all the people are passing by? Why didn't he give that in the briefing? It's his last chance? That could be. That is one possibility. I think there's another one. I'll see if you land on this one. He didn't want Absalom to die, right? I think he probably was hoping that there would be a second chance with Absalom. That maybe this would turn Absalom's heart around, right? And I know that none of us parents are guilty of this kind of dealing with our children, right? I mean, we want to always be very generous with our kids in their failings and to always want to give them another chance. And I think he does here. I think one of the reasons that maybe he's shouting this out in front of everybody, who's leading one of the groups of this army? Joab. Does Joab have a history of dealing gently with enemies? No. I think David probably knows that if Joab finds Absalom, that's it. And so he commands in public, hoping to bind Joab just a little bit more with public opinion so that everybody knows, here's what I want. I want you to deal gently with a man. Notice he doesn't call him my son. He calls him the young man, Absalom. Okay. Why do you think he does that? It does make him sound a little more innocent, right? Yeah. He's a young man. He doesn't really know what he's doing. So, good decision or bad decision on David's part? Tough call, isn't it? if your son were trying to kill you, how would you handle this? It's probably not something we can answer, is it? Not being in the situation, probably most of us parents would do the same thing. Deal gently with the young man. All the people heard it. So I think David knows Joab's tendency towards vengeance, and I think he's trying to bind him up there with public opinion a little bit. So verse 6, the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. So Ephraim, or Ephraim, is the northern part of Israel. It encompasses both sides of the Jordan River. It's an interesting statement that he talks about this big forest that's there. Because guess what isn't there right now? There are no forests in Israel at this point. This is one of the things that tells us that the landscape has changed a lot since David's time. It has been ravaged by wars for 3,000 years since David's life. The climate has changed there. You know, all these man-made carbon emissions going into the air. I'm joking about that. But the land has changed. So there was a huge forest there that is noted in this particular battle, and it doesn't exist anymore. It's all been cut down and done away with. So it was fought in the forest of Ephraim. Verse 7, here is one of the shortest accounts of a major battle probably to occupy our history books. Because the battle itself is not what's important in this. The outcome of the battle is what's important. But he's going to describe the battle in very, very short terms, and that is verse 7. The men of Israel were defeated by the servants of David, and the loss was great on that day, 20,000 men. That's a huge number. That's almost as many men as we lost in the entire Revolutionary War. About 25,000 casualties in the Revolutionary War. 20,000 men on one day. Now, we're not given the numbers. We don't know how many people Absalom had, and we don't know exactly how many people David had. But 20,000 is a big number of people to lose. And so it's no wonder that the servants of Israel were defeated. But verse 8, the battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. This is part of what tells us that that forest was not just a grouping of a couple of trees. This had to have been a dense forest, probably full of some animals and things that didn't like all the soldiers running through as well. But this was a dense forest. It was treacherous ground. Of course, that area is an area of lots of hills and valleys, so it's not a flatland that you're going through. So up and down all those mountains, great chance for people to fall and tumble down the hill or hit themselves with rocks or maybe to get your hair tangled in the branches of a tree. You have to watch out for those sorts of things. So, but Israel was defeated before David's men. And this is exactly what Hushai said would happen to Absalom. You know your father's men are mighty men of valor. These are not green recruits. These are mighty men. They know what war is about, and they're able to fight. And so they do put Israel to flight. And so while Israel's running away and trying to hide themselves, David's men are chasing them and cutting them down. And they clearly, this isn't a battle that ends with no clear victor. It's very abundantly clear that David's men win the day. Verse 9, Absalom is out in the battle. He's amongst his troops, and while his men are running, he probably is as well. And so, verse 9, Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Just happened to. Any such thing as coincidences in life? Now, that word happen doesn't imply any concept in the Hebrew of our ideas about fate or circumstance. We know there's no such thing as a circumstance. Because if you go back to chapter 17 and verse 14, this is where Hushai is giving his advice. The last sentence of the verse says, "For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel." Why? So that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. This is exactly where God wanted Absalom to be. He didn't happen in our sense. There was no uncertainty about it in God's plan. But it did happen. Absalom encountered the servants of David, probably fleeing because all his men are running for their lives, and so he probably is not standing there gallantly holding his ground against all of David's men. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, and he was suspended between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him went on. It's almost a comical scene, if it weren't so tragic, to see Absalom hanging there by his hair, and he gets his head caught. Now, we know that Absalom had very long hair, because at the end of the year, he would cut it off, and as we read a few chapters ago, it weighed almost 6 pounds. That's some thick, wavy locks he's got going on there. And at this point, it doesn't do him any favors. Probably why, Dan, what did they do this to you when you joined the military? What kind of haircut did you get? Buzz. They take it all off, right? There's probably a reason for that. So it doesn't get in your way. And you don't have to worry about your combing your hair in the morning, right? We're all the same. Yep. But you don't want that long hair because it's in a battle, it is a danger. Somebody grabs a hold of it and yanks on it, you're pretty likely to go with them or go down or whatever it is they're trying to do by yanking on your hair. So Absalom, going through this thick forest, gets himself stuck in this tree, and the mule doesn't know that. We talked this morning about stubborn mules. They don't care much what you think. And so as Absalom was trying to slow the thing down and the whole boy, get him to stop moving, it didn't care, and it just walked right off and left him hanging there, suspended between heaven and earth. And so as I said, if it weren't such a tragic story, it would almost be comical to see him hung there like that. But he is, at this point, completely helpless. What are you going to do to undo yourself from this? There's a good chance he doesn't have a sword with him anymore, or he could try to cut himself free. But whatever happened, he's got himself so entangled that he can't get out. And I think God has orchestrated the events of this battle in such a way as to visibly illustrate for us how helpless we are at times. Under the sovereign hand of God, our plans mean nothing. God is the one who's in control. And he's bringing Absalom to this end on purpose, right? Well, verse 10, Absalom's hanging there, and a certain man saw it and told Joab, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." So he didn't do anything about it. Why do you think he didn't do anything about it? Because David said, "Don't hurt them. Don't hurt Absalom." So he does what any good soldier would do. He reports to his commanding officer, "Hey, the general of the bad guy army is hanging over there in the tree. He's stuck. What should we do about it?" Well, Joab unleashes a tirade on the guy here. He's got a little temper tantrum to throw. Joab said to the man who told him, "What, you saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." Now, a belt might not sound like much payment to us, but understand clothing was not nearly as easy to come by then. You didn't just run to Kohl's and grab a couple things off the rack. It all had to be custom made, and even the cloth itself had to be woven, right? So we have things pretty easy these days, and we make our belts out of, what is that material? Malgahide or some kind of genuine imitation leather, right? How you do that, I'm not sure. How do you make genuine imitation leather? But if you want a belt, you have to have one made. It's all very, very custom and therefore expensive. And so 10 pieces of silver and a belt was a pretty good price to succeed in this mission. And so Joab says, "Why didn't you kill him right there? You had a perfect opportunity. If he's hanging in this tree helpless, we didn't even have to worry about getting struck yourself. Just throw your sword at him or something. Kill the guy and I would have paid you for it." I love how the man responds to this, though. Right there, we see that Joab's loyalties are not necessarily to what David wants, are they? Joab doesn't particularly care what David ordered in this instance. Joab, throughout his life, has had a very pragmatic view of things. Whatever's going to work the best is what he's going to do. And so if it works best to kill somebody, he has no problem murdering them. And so killing a man in battle is not considered murder. That's battle. That happens. How about killing a man when he's hanging helpless from his by his hair in a tree? Yeah, okay, the battle's still going on. The bell hasn't rung yet. Yeah, but he's helpless. You know, maybe it's not the time to go killing him. But Abishai and Joab have done this before. All right? They're not afraid to pursue somebody that's already defeated and try to kill them. And so this character is coming out again in Joab. And so he says, I want the guy dead. I think that in Joab's mind, he's probably thinking this is the best thing for David, because leave Absalom alive. Most of Israel wants Absalom to be king. This is a politically an expedient decision. Get rid of Absalom. That's going to be the only way to secure David on the throne after this. Because there were enough people who wanted David out that if Absalom is still alive, those people will never side with David. So I think Joab is probably thinking about the political expediency of things, but it does show us that Joab's heart's not really with David per se. He just wants to keep power. He wants to make sure that he stays where he's at, and the best way to do that is to keep David where he's at. Well, this man understands Joab's character, because look at how he responds to this. Even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, not a small fortune, by the way, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. What did David call Absalom? Young man. What's this man call Absalom? The king's son. So this guy's recognizing that the relationship there is what's driving David to want mercy for Absalom. I would not stretch out my hand against the king's son, not for any price of money. Why not? Because in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. So this man specifically heard the command, and he's obeying the order. Something else he recognizes. First of all, we see he's very, very loyal to David, because he's not willing to strike Absalom. But secondly, he knows Joab's character of treachery. On the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, that's against Absalom's life, and there is nothing hidden from the king. In other words, if I dealt treacherously and I killed Absalom like this, the king would hear about it. And if the king heard about it, Joab, where would you be? Gotta love this next line. You yourself would have stood aloof. What does that mean? If I had killed Absalom and the king heard about it, what would Joab say? Right now you're promising to pay me money if I kill him, but if I actually had killed him of my own accord and the king heard about it, what would Joab say? Oh, I told my men not to touch him, king. You better execute this guy for disobeying orders. Court-martial time. Oh, he says, you would have stood aloof. He knows how treacherous Joab can be. I don't know if you would have said anything like this to your commanding officer. But this guy's pretty bold to stand up for what's right like this to a guy like Joab, especially knowing Joab's history. But verse 14, Joab said, I will not waste time like this with you. In other words, be quiet, I'm not listening to you anymore. And he took 3 javelins in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. Here we got another instance of Joab showing himself he's not afraid to murder a man who's defenseless. No way that Absalom is still involved in the battle. He has been disarmed. He has been rendered helpless, but Joab is so intent on making sure that he's dead that he takes this opportunity, throws 3 javelins through his heart while he's still alive. I find it amazing that Absalom is not yet dead. I mean, I think if I took 3 javelins to the heart, I'd probably surrender myself pretty quickly. But he's not dead yet. And so Joab sends 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. Probably not just making sure he's dead. You can imagine that there's most likely some mutilation going on here. They hack him to pieces as a sign of what a contemptible enemy he was. And so Joab stands here over Absalom's mutilated body. Verse 16, then Joab blew the trumpet, because he knows, just like David was the key to victory, Absalom is the key to victory. Now that Absalom's gone, there's nothing left for the army of Israel to fight for. They're all running. They've been defeated. Their commander's dead. So Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones. Why do you think they buried Absalom right there in the forest? That's part of it, yeah. Being buried, separated from your family tomb was a sign of great shame. If you weren't buried in the grave of your fathers, that was a sign of great shame. That you've been disconnected from your family, almost disowned. And so burying him in the forest was a sign of disrespect from Joab to Absalom. I think there might be something else going on here too, because if he just had Absalom thrust through with three javelins and then stabbed and killed, Absalom's body's probably not in very good shape at this point. And David's order was to what? Deal gently with him. I don't know. There might be an incongruity between deal gently with him and all the cuts and lacerations that he's got and puncture wounds, right? And so it would be obvious if they haul Absalom's body back, it's going to be very obvious that he was not killed in the course of battle. Because how are you going to get him down? You're going to have to cut the hair, or you're going to have to cut the oak branches, and so he's going to have all these sticks in his hair, or he's going to have no hair. That's going to be different. He's going to have three javelins pinned through him. It's going to be obvious that he was not struck down in the course of battle, that he was struck down some way else. David's going to know what Joab has done. And so I think probably Joab's trying to cover up what he's just done to Absalom. And so, he can come back now and say, well, you know, we found him and he was dead, and so we gave him a burial in the forest and heaped stones over him. And don't worry, David, we took care of him. But that's where he's at. They raised a very great heap of stones, and all Israel fled, everyone to his own home. This is a tumultuous time for Israel, because now who's king? Is he? Everybody wanted Absalom. They pretty much voted him out. They kicked him out of the city. But now there's nobody standing in David's way to come back, right? But what do kings typically do when they put down military coups? It's not pretty, is it? We just saw this in Turkey here not that long ago. Somebody tried to oust the Turkey president. It didn't work. And there has been a bloodbath over there. Because he's now going through, searching through all the ranks of people, both military and civilian, trying to out all of the people that didn't support him. They're afraid this is what's going to happen now. David comes back to Jerusalem. Who's to say he's not going to unleash a wave of terror on Israel, striking down everybody that stood against him? It was fairly common back in those days. It's fairly common in much of the world today. We're just so shielded from it because we live in a still very biblically oriented society. Even though we recognize we're turning away from God's truth, we are still a peaceful society because there's so much biblical truth infused in our culture. Right? We typically don't go off and kill all of our political opponents. But that's not the way most of the world works. And so, there you have it. Israel flees and they're afraid. Now, verse 18, Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar that is in the king's valley for Israel, or in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's monument to this day. I've seen that monument. It's pretty interesting, actually. Still there. Absalom's monument. I find a little bit of an interesting tidbit here for you to ponder, but I want you to go back to chapter 14, verse 27. Chapter 14, verse 27. Read through that real quickly and see if you can understand why I find this an interesting tidbit. What's that say about Absalom? He's not very close to his children. Absalom had how many sons? Three sons and a daughter. Now, wait a second. Now, go back to chapter 18. Why did Absalom build this pillar? I have no son. This crazy Bible, you can't trust it for anything. It contradicts itself all over the place, doesn't it? Okay, let's think of some answers. Pillar was built before the sons. Maybe they all died. So maybe, maybe he kind of disowned his sons or wouldn't take responsibility for them. You don't have to resort to saying the scriptures contradict themselves, right? So there are answers. I think probably the most likely one is that they died. They died young. They died before he could take the throne. And so there's nobody. Because notice, he doesn't say, I have no sons. He says, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. There's nobody left. And so it's very possible that Absalom's sons have died, and it just didn't get recorded for us. Right? But people will point to this stuff all the time and say, oh, that crazy Bible, you can't trust it. Full of contradictions. Doesn't mean it is. Look for answers. Doesn't mean that answer that we come up with is the right one, so we can't dogmatically say, well, Absalom's sons all died very young. Well, that's a possible explanation. It just shows us that you don't have to resort to the idea of a contradiction. Right? So that is Absalom's end. The rebellion has been put down. The leader's been killed. All of the troops have been scattered. And Absalom becomes a great illustration for us of a very serious command that God gave in his covenant law to his people. You shall honor your father and your mother, and whoever curses his father and mother must die the death. Exodus 21. God takes that command pretty seriously, and here we have a great example of a man who would not honor his father. You can't get much more dishonoring than trying to oust your father from the throne, right? And Absalom becomes for us that negative example. Well, how not to be a good son? Even as much as David recognizes that it's his own failings that have brought all of this upon him, that doesn't mean that David's wrong justifies Absalom's wrong. We have to do right no matter what anybody else is doing. No matter what inclinations they've given us, no matter what motivations they've given us, through their wrong behavior. God always calls us to do what's right. And so can you, as an obedient son, honor a dishonorable father? Absolutely. Can you show honor to a parent who doesn't deserve it? Yeah. Should you? Yeah. Should David have disciplined his son, even if he wouldn't accept it? Yes, he should have. So the faults are all over the place. Here's one of the areas where the scriptures stand above other ancient history documents, is they are not afraid to show us the failings even of great heroes of the faith. David is constantly held up to us as an example of biblical faith, a man after God's own heart. And yet, how often now have we read about massive failings in his life? Aren't you glad God doesn't only love perfect people? God loves broken people. And God uses broken people. God blesses broken people. But he does take sin very seriously. And this whole episode is a result of both Absalom's sin and of David's. And it's got to be an impetus to us to be guarding ourselves and saying, Lord, how else can I improve my obedience to you? Not saying our sons will ever rebel against us and try and take over the company, right? Gary says, I'm ready to hand it over to him anyway. That'd be great. Any questions?